Good evening, everyone out there in Cooperative Radio Land. Tonight, it's time for Each for All, the Cooperative Connection here on Vancouver Co-op Radio. Tonight on the show, we have with us Aaron Windle, and he's an assistant professor from SFU in history. We're going to be learning a lot about the cooperative history of Africa, essentially from the 1870s all the way through to sort of modern day here, really through the lens of how the late colonial effort was trying to develop Africa using the co-op model as a sort of communitarian modernist project. Now, I'm using language from Aaron's actual book, so don't think that I know all these terms. But I wanted to start with a couple of excerpts from a movie that is very poignant in this this frame. We're talking about the movie from 1949, Daybreak in Udi, and it's about a village campaign to build a cooperative maternity hospital and hire midwives. And you'll get a sense of kind of that that colonialist administrator oversight of what we'll be talking about this evening. This is some excerpts from the movie Daybreak in Udi.
First of all, what kind of help are you expecting from me?
You give all the villages cement and timber, roofing material, and labor, skilled
yes,
labor.
Yes, right. True, I did. But then, what do they give me? They gave cooperation. You know, a lot of people imagine that this development is merely a matter of asking the government for this and that and the other. But even if the amount of money available were absolutely unlimited, charity would be absolutely useless.
We are not asking for charity.
Yes, I know that quite well. And I know your village well. The people really want progress, but they're not quite sure yet how to go about it.
That's why we came to see you.
Yes. Well, now, you know, your people are farmers, and farmers all over the world are just naturally suspicious of new ideas, even if they want them.
But they know you well.
Ah, yes, they know me, and they trust me in matters they understand. But you see, this community development's a new thing. It requires leadership of men and women like yourselves, who've seen a higher standard of living and haven't lost touch with the people they come from.
We are ready to do anything we can.
Excellent. But remember, the first thing is do not interfere with the traditional way of doing things in the village. First, try to persuade the elders to call a meeting of the whole village. Then try to persuade the whole village to turn out and collect the sand and the stone and clear the site and so on.
Well, you've told others what they can do, but what can I do?
Your job is straightforward enough. Try to persuade the women to form a cooperative society, to raise the money to pay the midwife's salary. But look, I'm in a hurry now, but Dominic knows all about it. Anyhow, whatever you do, call a meeting and I'll try and come myself.
So that is an excerpt from the Daybreak in Udi movie of 1949. My guest tonight on Each for All, the Cooperative Connection is Aaron Windle. He's the assistant professor at SFU in the history department. He's a historian of Britain, the British Empire, media and technology. Originally from Wisconsin, he moved to Vancouver and to SFU in 2012. Received his PhD from the University of Minnesota in British and African History, and now teaches at all three campuses here in Vancouver at SFU. Thanks so much for joining us tonight, Aaron. Great to have you on the
show. Thanks for having me.
So you and I just happened to cross paths at a party and started talking about co-ops.
Yeah.
It's crazy how that happens.
Yeah.
And I was really intrigued by your thesis here in your book about co-op history. You're sharing a vision of co-ops that not a lot of people hear about. Most people, you know, hear about co-ops. It's the rose-colored glasses. And here we're really looking back at a history of co-ops that does not really fit with our kind of conceptions of them, or certainly not maybe in our bubble here in Western Canada. You know, even thinking back about the Rochdale Pioneers and the history of the co-op movement, it's always been something to look up to a history where we're looking at people collaborating collectively for the common good. But your history, not so much. It seems a bit marred. you could just kind of start by painting us a little bit of the picture of why, I guess, how co-ops came to Africa.
Yeah. Well, you're absolutely right. When we think about the cooperative movement, we think about it as this egalitarian, democratic movement that's about emancipation for people who are struggling originally in the mid-19th century with the effects of industrialization. And so, as a British historian, there is a kind of purchase on the cooperative movement's history that comes from Britain and the Rochdale pioneers, and this notion that this is how communities come together to kind of forge a pathway of resistance against the capitalist and to kind of improve their lives. But democracy is at the center of it. The notion of the Rochdale pioneers and one man, one vote is a democratic principle. So you would think that when the cooperative movement is promoted by Britons all over the world, as it is from about the turn of the century, 19th to 20th century, all the way through to the end of the British Empire, you would think that therefore we're talking about a kind of democratic movement spreading across the world, and the British Empire is a kind of guardian or custodian of that movement. But when we really look at what's going on inside cooperative systems and inside the areas of colonial administration that are tasked with overseeing the movement, you see that there are all sorts of subversions of democratic process and differences when it comes to colonial subjects. When white Europeans, Britons, are administering the cooperative, they're very careful to make sure that there are controls built into it that prevent it from ever really being effectively a democracy. The really important one is this figure of the registrar, who looms large over the entire history of the cooperative movement in the British Empire. And he has the power, in many cases, to be able to dismiss all of the elected managers, for instance, of a cooperative society, to ban particular societies, to liquidate societies. So he has this awesome power that sort of gives the lie to the notion that in colonial situations, the cooperative could really be a democratic site. And what I find particularly inspiring is that in spite of all of that, you have people all over the world who take that, what we'll call a package of development, of community development coming from the British. They take it, they subvert it, they use it for their own ends, they repurpose it. And of course, this causes quite a bit of trouble when colonial administrators get very frustrated that Africans and Asians and others are taking their sort of best laid schemes of community development and turning them, in fact, against colonial rule, using them as spaces of resistance in which to actively engage in anti-colonial movements.
Well, and I know a couple of your chapters in your book are specific to the Ugandan African Farmers Union, and they really kind of tell that story very clearly. Before we get into that, I was curious also to understand, now, we're talking about Africa tonight, but is this, you mentioned Asia, is this also repeated in other British colonies around the world?
Absolutely. So the really important earliest place for colonial cooperatives under the British Empire is in India. And the idea here is this is at the turn of the century. For much of the last quarter of the 19th century, the British were really concerned about the problem of rural debt, especially in the west and north of India. They're thinking strategically about competing with the Russian Empire, for instance, for control in Central Asia. And they're thinking about the need to make sure that populations in India are not subversive, not undermining colonial authority. And they see rural debt as something that kind of foments rebellion or creates the conditions of possibility for rebellious movements. When people are deeply in debt, they're therefore more prone to acting in rebellious ways. And so the idea to start cooperatives comes out of that sort of search for a solution to a problem that really comes down to we're afraid of resistance. We're afraid that our rule is going to be subverted. And so they start to try to spread the cooperative movement. And the place where that really becomes kind of iconic is in the province of Punjab.
Well, tell us a bit more about what happens in Punjab.
So in Punjab, this is where the cooperative law gets kind of established and becomes kind of canon. So everywhere in the next 40, 50 years or so that the cooperative spreads throughout the British Empire, it's the Punjab law that's sort of the model for that. And the Punjab registrars become the leading experts throughout the British Empire. These are people who are writing books about rural debt, writing books about how cooperatives can be a panacea for all sorts of problems in colonial situations. And ultimately, one of the Punjab cooperatives registrars, a guy named Claude Strickland, becomes a kind of roving expert around the British Empire, where the colonial office based in London taps him to go on these tours, where he goes to East Africa, he goes to Malaya, he goes all over the world spreading the gospel of cooperative economics.
And so in your title of the book, you mentioned Britain's Third Empire. Is this what you're talking about, the traveling around and kind of pushing this cooperative solution?
Yeah. And well, what I mean by Britain's Third Empire is it's really Africa in the 20th century and the question of development. So in the 20th century, in the mid-1940s, right after the Second World War, Britain loses India. And suddenly there's a panic in Britain. What are we going to do? Now we've lost the jewel in the imperial crown. And so there's real concerted effort to kind of double down on Africa and to try to develop Africa, to make Africa pay, so to speak, as a colonial possession, but also to be that space that's sort of the last space of the British Empire that they're not going to give up. And so therefore, they're going to really develop it through this mechanism called community development. And the cooperative movement becomes the linchpin of that effort. So Britain's Third Empire is really a time, but it's also a place.
I see.
I borrowed that term from a radical leftist Marxist from the mid-20th century named George Padmore, who labels Africa Britain's Third Empire in his critical reading of Britain's efforts to develop the continent.
But even before the Second World War, you do talk about this idea of building the co-op movement in Africa. How does that, how does this become the solution to the problems of Africa?
Yeah. So what's different about Africa? When we look at India, the concern that the British have there is this problem of debt and how it could possibly push peasants into rebellion. So we have to solve the problem of rural debt in order to keep the province, the continent, peaceful. When it comes to Africa, the question is really about detribalization, which is a word that the colonial authorities use to talk about what's happening under the pressures of empire, the pressure of contact with European civilizations, with world economy, and how this is presenting stress on African social systems and the very tribal organizations and tribal systems that British rule wields itself through. So this is in the way in which Britain governed Africa. They looked for tribal authorities who had at least some modicum of legitimacy on the ground with people in local communities and tried to rule and govern through these systems. Well, what's happening by the 1920s, at least on the radar of the colonial office, is those systems are starting to break down under the pressure of social change and of culture change, which becomes the sort of watchword of the era. Everybody's worried about culture change and communities breaking down. And so suddenly people are thinking, administrators are asking, how can we start to glue back together a kind of disintegrating African society and make it effective once again as a kind of community space in which we can, through which we can govern? And that's where the cooperative comes in. This seems to be the perfect glue to reconnect disintegrating African society. So it's a different problem that administrators see in Africa, but the same solution, cooperatives.
And so are they looking back to the or to Britain, or are they looking back to India as the success?
Yes, they're looking back to India primarily. Okay. And then going, and this is where this fellow Claude Strickland comes into the picture, this Punjab expert, former registrar, who's sent on a tour starting in 1929, and for several years travels around East African colonies, goes to West Africa as well, and visits and advises governments on how they should frame their law, their cooperative law, how they should frame their systems of inspection, audit, publicity and so on to make sure that the movement takes on the form that it needs to take. But that form always has the registrar sitting at the top and really rigid rules to prevent societies from going astray. And one of the major ways that a society could go astray is to become politically involved in just about any cause. So there's an effort to sort of wire in to the cooperative law and the administrative structure of cooperative rule, an effort to wire in a kind of inability for cooperators to be able to turn political, and a worry about this possibility that they could.
You also mentioned in your introduction that this is a book about colonial politics, but also technopolitics.
Yeah.
And I wonder if you can kind of unpack that term, technopolitics.
Well, techno as in machines and systems. And so politics that work through the application of systems. A lot of times historians will talk about technopolitics and they'll mean actual machines. So we'll talk about the technopolitics, for instance, of the nuclear era. And they're really interested in actual machinery and those sorts of technologies and how there can be a political purpose behind them and how interested people can wield a politics that through machinery and through building mechanical technological systems. I think about the effort to try to deploy the cooperative movement throughout the world by the British Empire as a kind of effort at creating a system. So a technology of rule, or a political technology. So when I talk about technopolitics, I'm talking about the cooperative as a vast system that can produce all sorts of political effects, not just economic growth, not just improvement of people's sort of, you know, bottom line at the grassroots level, but also other political effects, a kind of anti-politics machine, if you will, that turns it away from political radicalism and streams African and other colonial people into a kind of harmonious relationship with colonial governments.
Yeah, you've already mentioned the term cooperative rule, from what I gather, it's, you know, intended to stabilize this colonial order. You also mentioned the term of British trained values, and I'm guessing this is all kind of part of, I mean, this is very much feels like colonialism and imperialism around the world. How was that received in Africa during this time?
Yeah, so I take that term cooperative rule actually from one of the major voices of imperial statecraft in the 20th century, Lord Lugard, who doesn't coin the term indirect rule, but he's sort of the administrator over colonial Nigeria who does most to innovate and come up with the rules by which indirect rule, this way of ruling through tribal indigenous systems. And when he comes across the work that's being done with cooperatives in Punjab and starts to see the possibility of building this into a kind of system of government in Africa, he says, oh, I wish that I could just rebrand the term indirect rule and call it instead cooperative rule, because this is really what I mean. And how Africans and others receive it, there's ambivalence there. Some go along with it. Some Africans enroll in cooperatives and register in cooperatives and play by the rules of the system set out by Strickland, Lugard, and others. But that's not the norm. The more typical reception that I find is people who already have in communities techniques of cooperative economics that the British were completely unaware of. They go by different names. They don't use the name cooperative. They go by an indigenous word. For instance, in the Igbo language, in the film that you just played a clip of, it's Esuzu cooperative. This is a rotating credit society where you put in contributions, and then on a rotating basis, people who have paid into the system get a kind of rotating payout. So there are all sorts of cooperative-type economic enterprises that colonial people all over the world in the British Empire are already doing before the British come on the scene with the idea that we're going to give the cooperative movement to colonial peoples. And those persist. Those systems persist. But there are also farmers who see the utility of organizing marketing cooperative, Raiffeisen-type cooperatives, but they're not at all interested in enrolling, registering within the the official cooperative movement. In fact, they use that kind of as a slur. Like in Uganda, for instance, in the late 1940s, there's a difference for most farmers between the true cooperators, of which they consider themselves to be a part, and then the official cooperative movement of the state. So they want the cooperative economics. They already were doing it before the British got there. But what the British law does is it says that if anybody's using the word cooperative, they have to be registered under the state system. And that comes with all of these concessions, including autonomy, including allowing this undemocratic registrar to sit over your society and dictate how your society will function.
That's pretty crazy. And the this idea of this indirect rule, it sounds very much like they're kind of pushing like an economic state model. Even though it's democratic, you're still talking about business organizations essentially having the democratic power. Maybe that's better, I don't know, but certainly not under an oppressive, co-op registrar.
Absolutely. And as it's wielded by colonial authorities, they stress the economic side of it and the business side of it. And what are cooperatives good for? They're good for training business sense, training fluencies in cash economy, dealing with cash and these sorts of things. But not at all the kind of democratic potentialities that I think have always been there in the cooperative movement. And it's those democratic potentialities that when you see them embraced by Africans, for instance, in the story of the Uganda African Farmers Union, they become quite inspiring and quite powerful, enrolling many, many more people in an anti-colonial cooperative movement than the British are able to do with their official cooperative movement.
Well, I really do want to get into talking about this because it's also a fascinating story. But I'm going to play another excerpt from the movie Daybreak in Udi. And this is towards the end of the movie, once they've established the maternity hospital and everything is coming to fruition and they're talking about the future.
Ask them to keep quiet. First of all, I want to congratulate the elders and the people of Umana village on the building of this maternity home. I realize it has not been built without opposition from some foolish people. The value of the work that you have done is not to be measured in the number of bricks that you have made or even in the size of the building. It lies in the power that you have demonstrated in doing the work and the spirit you have put into it. When we first started this work, one village collected £10 and they gave it to the elders. And they brought it to me and said, we want civilization. I told them you cannot buy civilization like food in a market. In civilization, people matter more than money. If you wish to catch up with more advanced people and raise your standard of life, then I say you've made a good start. But you're only one of 40 villages in the Abadja clan that has done just that. So my advice to you now that you've woken up is this. Do not shame yourselves and the rest of the Badger clan by stopping here. As though this effort had completely exhausted your strength. You must build your own future. Nobody else can do it for you. But remember this. The people of my country will be only too glad to help you when they hear what you're doing to help yourselves. Well, I hope and I expect that all of you are wondering what you can do next. I've just heard that the people of Amanciodo are going to make a road from their village to the next village. And as this is a particularly difficult road to make, I propose to invite some of the elders to come with me to see the work being undertaken. Incidentally, they call the road Ike Dingpa, which, as we all know, means by the power of strong men.
And yeah, that seems to be kind of rounding out that that colonial history and that, you know, British trained values being kind of pushed upon people a bit. And yeah, a really interesting
movie. That film actually won an Oscar. Yeah, when it was released. What I like about that film is that it shows community development. The idea there where he says, if you want to develop, you have to do it by yourselves. We can give you advice, we can give you some of the tools, but the work has to come from yourselves. That's the essence of community development. There are lots of different ways an empire might develop, building things, building roads, building bridges, trains, etc. Community development of the 20th century is this insistence that development has to come from the grassroots. And so here's the cooperative to teach people how to do this. But I think what it obscures is that what are the British doing in these places in the first place? There's this notion here that you see in this film that this is all about giving something, giving tools, giving the ability to pull yourselves up from your bootstraps, so to speak. But the British, meanwhile, are harvesting tons and tons of commodities and repatriating them to Britain for their own purposes. So it kind of gives a notion that this is all about development, all about community development. There's something else behind it.
But in your book as well, you talk about the co-op party and the co-op union back in Britain being very supportive of these efforts, to bring cooperativism around the world. Do they really feel like they're making a difference?
Absolutely. Well, a good example of that is what they do with that particular film. They take cooperators from all over Britain, go to see that movie, and they get very inspired by the work that's going on throughout the empire to build the cooperative movement. Daybreak in Udi is, you know, there's at cooperative conferences, there's a song that's sung that includes the metaphor of daybreak in the cooperative light, the idea that the cooperative light is rising up like the sun and is going to shine over the entire world. And yeah, members of the cooperative party are really interested in it. But the closer they get to seeing what's actually happening with the system and seeing some of the resistance that starts to emerge when Africans confront the controls and the powerful role of the registrar and the anti-politics provision on all of this, is some of those members of the cooperative party and some of those who are really invested in cooperatives in Britain start to become critical of what's happening in the empire.
And so you talk about how we start to see this anti-colonial cooperative movement start in the late 1940s. I think that this is happening in Uganda mostly and around coffee and cotton farmers.
Yeah.
So how does this kind of lead us through how this evolves?
Yeah. Well, first of all, it's happening all over the empire. The cooperative becomes the sector of cooperatives becomes a critical pressure point in movements of decolonization throughout the British Empire. So the British are constantly worried. One of the critical spots is Cyprus, where a communist party has taken over, infiltrated the cooperative movement there. And they're very nervous about what's going to happen with cooperatives there. So it's really happening all over the empire. But I find one of the most interesting stories where you really start to see how it's the failure of democracy inside the colonial system that becomes the catalyst for an anti-colonial movement in Uganda. And that's around this story of the Uganda African Farmers Union and their coffee and their cotton farmers in the late 1940s. Their political cause is democratization. They want, some of them, an end altogether of colonial rule, but at the very least, they want a better relationship or a better kinder version of colonial rule. And they come up against the cooperative law and the system and the power of the registrar, and they identify this as the thing that is sort of standing in their way of real grassroots African development, a kind of modernization that's going to come from Africans and not from Europeans. And so they buck against these rules, they push against it, and they organize a massive farmers marketing cooperative to try to purchase ginneries for their cotton and coffee curing plant, to try to take over the major agricultural industries of of the Ugandan economy, and they hope as well to bring the colonial economy to a grinding halt. So they wield the power of the boycott. So there's this thin line in African practice, in African radical anti-colonial practice, between the cooperative movement, between the cooperative and the boycott. Really, the part of the purpose of organizing cooperatives for these farmers becomes the ability to then have an organizational structure to communicate with each other and to tell each other when to withhold their crops, when to withhold their cotton, when to withhold their coffee from the marketplace, so that they can bring the colonial economy to a halt and then push for change, push for democracy.
So is there no political structure within Uganda at this time? Like, what does that look like? Is there no other avenues?
There are definitely indigenous systems that are brought into this system of indirect rule that the British Protectorate government is governing through. So there are a kind of parliamentary type body named the Lukiko in Uganda. There is a hereditary king called the Kabaka, and he's somebody that the British government is allied with and has legitimacy for many Baganda people. But it's not democratic, right? It's not, they're not willing, the British authority is not willing to have plebiscites, votes that would elect members to these parliamentary bodies.
Interesting. Okay. I mean, I just have no clue about what this would look like back then. we're seeing these quite corrupt co-op registrars, it sounds like. They're really coordinating coordinating this idea of the co-op rule or the indirect rule and I guess exploiting the resources and getting goods out of the country at exploitively cheap prices? Is that kind of the purpose?
That's pretty much the game.
Okay.
Everywhere in the British Empire, In fact, I think we might just say that that's if we were to put that on the tombstone of the British Empire, it would be pretty apt. We managed to get commodities and resources out of colonies throughout the world, and the cooperative system has something to do with that. It is supposed to make peasant economies more efficient in terms of getting produce out to the marketplace.
So prior to this introduction of co-ops, though, what would it have looked like? Would it have actually been British organizations coming in and purchasing labor or whatever to produce this and get it out? And now we're starting to see the co-ops form as a result?
So before this, and before the effort of the Uganda African Farmers Union to purchase ginneries and purchase coffee curing plant, there's a monopoly by European settlers and by Asian settlers as well, which is actually in Uganda a larger community. And they possess all of the processing equipment for taking cotton from raw cotton to something that could be sold on a marketplace to service the textile mills of, you know, well, Lancashire and Britain, but all over the world. And they have monopolies over these systems. They own all the machinery, and Africans are officially barred from owning this equipment. The licenses aren't given out by the colonial authorities to Africans. And that is, from the vantage point of the colonial authority, this is smart because it means that the various communities that need to be represented in this place all have some section of the colonial economy, but Africans are slotted in the role of workers, peasants and workers. And so what the Uganda African Farmers Union is trying to do is to pool the capital, pool the resources of African farmers to be able to take over those ginneries and that coffee curing plant, but they come up again against a political bar that says that we won't give you those licenses and we won't sell you that machinery. And so they have to then engage in boycotts to be able to push through the political system to finally get concessions from the state that allow them to actually take on this equipment.
And we're not talking about like a handful of farmers here, right?
No, we're talking at its height about 80,000 cotton and coffee farmers in Buganda, which is the power center of Uganda and the seat of colonial rule. which is a massive farmers' movement, and so much larger than the official, as the farmers will slur the colonial system. The official cooperative movement is much, much smaller, dwarfed by this massive anti-colonial cooperative movement that aims to topple the colonial regime altogether.
And so you mentioned that they organized in secret and waged this propaganda war. First of all, organizing 80,000 people in secret, that's a challenge unto itself.
So they don't start out in secret. They start out, one of the things that recommends for them the cooperative movement in the first place is that here we can have political groups, political meetings and organizations that, when we call ourselves cooperatives, we can meet in the open. We can come out into the clear. But once they start to organize and that threat starts to become visible to colonial authorities, the society is banned. And the immediate cause for banning the society is there's a big rally outside the Kabaka's palace, and farmers are demanding democratization of Uganda. And that rally, there's a confrontation between protesters and police, and disturbances, quote-unquote disturbances, ensue over a period of a couple of days, and there's destruction of property and other things that lead the colonial administration to impose emergency rule over Uganda in, I believe it's mid-April 1949. So for the next 2 years, the UAFU, the Uganda African Farmers Union, is a proscribed society. They're illegal and underground. And so all of their leaders go to London, where there are actually looser rules in terms of what they can write and say and how they can organize, or they go into hiding. And the movement continues to meet in secret. They still have rallies, but they're underground and constantly worried about the threat of police and military and the sedition law being used to stifle and shut up their movement.
And so what are those political leaders who've escaped? What are they writing about?
So the most important one to the story, there are two really important ones. Ignatius Musazi, who is he's a Baganda, he's actually a son of an aristocrat, but he's somebody who has a real heart for the lower peasant farmer class. He studies in Britain, and he's in Britain in the 1920s when British workers go out on a general strike in 1926. And he thinks, oh my God, I can take this, and I can take these ideas of trade union activity and the cooperative movement, and I can bring these back to my people, and we can organize movements against the colonial regime using these methods. So he becomes, a little bit earlier in 1945, a leader of the Transport Workers Union in Kampala that has a massive strike that then sets off a whole reaction from the colonial administration and imposition of emergency rule for a time then. And so he's sort of on the lam for a while and organizing in secret, but he's the leader of the movement. And then there's another person named Simakula Malumba, and he is an associate of Musazi's, and together they organize in London, and they recruit allies in the Cooperative Party and amongst cooperators in Britain. They find parliamentarians who will speak on their behalf on the floor of Parliament and bring light to their cause. And it's really crucial to their movement back in Uganda that they have this support from Britain.
So what happens?
So in the end, the farmers win. The threat of what the farmers have that the colonial authorities always know they have, and is really a sort of ace up the sleeve, is what some historians of peasant economics will call the exit option. You can always leave the cash market. So, right, what's the value of cotton, the value of coffee, is in its cash value on a global marketplace. Well, peasants have this power to leave that and just grow something else on their farms. So the exit option, the ability to leave the cash nexus and the marketplace altogether and return to subsistence farming, is a really powerful tool for them. It's what allows them to allow this the boycotts to continue for as long as they do. Eventually, the pressure of withholding cotton and withholding coffee become so intense for the colonial regime that there's a changing of the guard in Government House. The governor is fired, essentially. They use a nicer word for it, and they reassign him to another location. But somebody else is brought in who has sort of socialistic leanings, and he starts to rewrite the rules and insists that we basically have to concede to all of these farmers' demands if we're ever going to have a situation where the official cooperative movement isn't in all-out competition with anti-colonial cooperative movements in the colony.
Wow. That's a great story.
Thank you.
And so what does Uganda, does the Uganda Farmer Union exist today? What does that look like?
It doesn't today. And in fact, it's sort of one of these stories where because the organization was politics first, and it really was an anti-colonial movement that saw cooperatives as something useful for pushing forward this movement, a way of organizing farmers that wasn't there before. Once they get the concessions, and once they have the entire cooperative law rewritten so that it accommodates their position and allows them to be vocally political in the open, suddenly people are free to join the official cooperative movement. Mm-hmm. And so the actual Uganda African Farmers Union, they actually have to shutter during the emergency and change their name to another organization to find some room for maneuver during the actual emergency between 49 and 51. But after the rules are changed, after the law is changed, the society's just sort of, it falls apart, and the individual groups start to join the official cooperative movement.
And is there still a pretty large co-op movement there?
Yeah, absolutely.
Cool. Now, I was intrigued to read the phrase that these were, this is information you got from recently declassified archives.
Yes.
What are those?
Okay, like, so
what are the archives?
So they are known as the FCO-141 series, and this comes out of a court case about 10 years ago in Britain, and descendants of political prisoners and people who have been persecuted in Kenya during the so-called Mau Mau Rebellion in the 1950s. Some of them were tortured, some of them were killed, some of them were hanged, and their descendants sued. And in a high court case about 10 years ago, they sued for damages, but they also sued for a recognition that there were secret archives that chronicled the entire oppression, this whole episode of a kind of dirty war in Kenya perpetrated by the colonial regime. They sued for recognition that a secret archive existed, and it had been secreted away at the end of the colonial era. There's a memo that basically goes out to governments in the 1960s that says, if you have any secret documents, if you have any documents that are going to really embarrass we British, if Africans or Asian national movements take over, if these fall into the wrong hands, we're going to be embarrassed on the global stage. And so if you have any documents, you need to send them really quickly back to Britain so we can hide them. And this happens all over the empire. These documents come in boxes, and thousands, hundreds of thousands of pages of documents get hidden away in an archive that shares space with MI6 in the English Midlands. And they sit there, and nobody knows about them until these descendants of those who had been tortured during the independence struggle in Kenya sue and get the High Court to recognize that the archive exists. And once that happens, the archive has to start to bring its hidden documents to the light of day and send them over to the National Archives. So for the past 10 years, rafts of these documents have been coming over from this secret archive. And some portions of them are still redacted, but there's a fair amount of new information we have about the decolonization of the British Empire. And it was anything but a kind of happy sort of shaking of hands and willful parting of the ways. It's in every place, in every instance, a violent encounter and efforts to try to hold on to authority against movements of popular resistance. And that's all chronicled in these secret files.
That's wild. I have no idea that exists.
But it also gives us the clearest sense of what's happening inside the struggle between the official cooperative movement and this grassroots anti-colonial cooperative movement. The sort of day-to-day TikTok of that struggle is documented and now available.
Well, and I'm as a historian, this must be a bit of a windfall in the sense of like. So much information that you didn't have privy to before this.
Absolutely. It stopped me in my path. The book would have been a very, very different book had I not come across these documents, had these releases of these formerly classified documents not happened. And I don't think that the Uganda farmers would have occupied about a half of the book as they do right now.
Well, and I really appreciate you sharing their story with us tonight, and also just giving us a really different perspective on co-ops. This is not something that we talk about here on Each for All. We talk about, you know, our local co-ops and our other larger co-op institutions around. For the most part, these are really kind of, in a sense, feel-good stories. The fact that co-ops and the co-op movement, maybe you wouldn't call it the co-op movement, but the co-op structure being used as a vehicle of essentially a yoke on a society, right, is really a different perspective completely.
Right. And then what I find inspiring is that, in fact, in the end, there is this story of Africans who are also cooperators and deeply committed and invested in the cooperative movement, who recognize that if it's going to live up to its potential, it has to be democratic, and therefore it has to be anti-colonial. So, in fact, they kind of resuscitate the old spirit of mid-19th century Rochdale weavers and working-class radicals who are struggling against the forces of capitalism and industrialization. They do it, but theirs is a dual struggle against capitalism plus empire, and they tap into that history and find a way to, I think, renew it in a really powerful way.
Fantastic. Thanks so much, Aaron. It's been such a pleasure. Our guest tonight has been Aaron Windel. He is the assistant professor in history at SFU, PhD from the University of Wisconsin. If you're taking classes at SFU, you can check him out. He's doing classes at all the campuses. His book is Cooperative Rule, The Politics of Community Development in Britain's Third Empire. Thanks so much, Aaron.
Thank you.
We're going to say goodnight here at Each for All, the Cooperative Connection. That's it for us this Tuesday. If you have any questions, email or tweet them to us. Ideas@eachforall.coop is our email, and on Twitter @eachforall.